May it please the Court. My name is Patrick Otluski on behalf of Petitioner Appellant Daqua Gray. This case involves a clear and undisputed violation of Apprendi. A jury found Gray guilty of first-degree murder. Later at sentencing, a judge imposed the 60-year maximum for first-degree murder and then tacked on another 20 years based on his own finding that an aggravating factor applied.
But Mr. Otluski, maybe I could kind of cut to the chase here.
Sure.
Suppose that we were to agree with you that there has not been procedural default on some of the ineffectiveness of counsel. Let's say both, the ineffectiveness of sentencing counsel and the ineffectiveness of appellate counsel. And we then turned to the Apprendi error, which the Illinois court seemed to agree happened. Nobody seems to be really fighting
right.
That one. But the Supreme Court in Washington against Requenco has said that Apprendi errors can be subject to a plain error type or a harmless error type of analysis. And the standard for harmless error in habeas is the Brecht against Abrahamson standard. It's not harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. The Supreme Court goes through a long discussion about how they don't want it to be that strict a standard in collateral cases. And that takes you to something that looks very factual to me, trying to assess whether this act of Mr. Gray, of plugging this man when he's down with three bullets, should be considered to be wanton and cruel and all the rest of that. I don't see how, once we get to the very end of this line, following the way you want us to go, we can do anything but say, whatever Apprendi error there was, he can't show prejudice. I guess that would be one way of putting it.
Sure. And I'll answer your question in two steps. First, the low-hanging fruit. Fry v. Plyler says that there's no deference afforded to the state court's resolution of Gray's whether Gray was prejudiced by the Apprendi error. That was a recent case by the Supreme Court in 2007. So there's no deference to the Illinois appellate court's decision that Gray was not prejudiced by the Apprendi error, nor to the sentencing judge's initial determination that the aggravating factor applied. And turning to the actual harmlessness question, understanding...
And even Judge Kennelly didn't think that there was prejudice. I mean, he is sitting as a federal district court judge, looks at this set of facts.
And that's correct. And again, the standard review of Judge Kennelly's decision is de novo. But I actually think if you look at Judge Kennelly's decision, he was relying quite heavily on the reasoning of the sentencing judge and the Illinois appellate court. But what we're dealing with is just a process question, whether as a matter of federal due process, the 80-year sentence is the result of a lack of evidence on this question of brutal and heinous behavior indicative of wanton cruelty. And when you line that up with Brecht, it's not easy because we're not matching elements to evidence. We're not asking whether there is evidence that goes to the question both prejudice and under the Strickland sense, based on facts that were presented at trial. We're talking about facts from first-degree murder and whether those map on to this 20-year enhancement. And as we put in our brief, there just isn't that much at trial that we can go on for that question. And that's where the Brecht analysis becomes very difficult in this case.
Could there have been? I mean, there doesn't seem at this stage of the game we have to accept the underlying facts as the Illinois appellate court stated them. And you've done that. I mean, it seems everybody's doing what they should do.
Sure.
I don't know what else you think could have been found. I mean, certainly in this post-Apprendi world, his trial was before Apprendi had been decided. We all know about this coming up on the direct appeal. But the ultimate question is there reason to send it back for a jury finding on the especially wanton and cruel and heinous element, or is it I think it's under the Brecht standard that we have to ask whether there was prejudice here.
No, I absolutely agree with you that the Brecht standard applies. If we take Judge Kennelly's decision and break it down a little bit, looking at the first thing that he found, he thought that the crime was premeditated and unprovoked. So we laid out in our brief, I don't think that's quite right based on the facts that presented at trial. The case started as a pure theft. And then somehow and it's very unclear from the record, there's this individual, Tommy Smith, hanging out on the corner of 163rd Street in Honoré down in Markham, Illinois. They ran into Tommy Smith. Tommy Smith pulled a gun and shot the victim point blank in the forehead. At some point, We don't know how much time elapsed. We don't know what the chain of events was. All we have is a witness statement from Tim Montgomery, who was standing by a garage down the street, that Tommy Smith ran by Doc McGray, handed him the gun, and he went over and then fired the additional three shots into the side of his head.
And so, why couldn't a rational court... I mean, your argument, it seems a little ghoulish, actually. Your argument seems to be that since the victim was already either unconscious or possibly even well on the road to death, it's impossible that it could be an act of wanton cruelty. And I'm not sure that's right, actually. It suggests that anything you do to an unconscious victim can't be wantonly cruel. Is there any legal support for that notion?
There is, to the extent on the, not necessarily on the unconsciousness part, but in People v. Alvarez, the Illinois courts found that jumping out from behind a bush and shooting an individual in the back of the head did not warrant the application of the extended sentence aggravating factor. And, you know, this dialogue is pretty much showing why there is such a question and why the Brecht standard should apply, and shows that the error was not harmless. There's just all these open questions.
But in terms of the legal characterization, as opposed to who found the fact, but in terms of the legal characterization of this conduct, don't we already know in this case how the Illinois courts look at it?
We don't. We know how the Illinois appellate court would look at it. We don't know what a jury would do.
Well, we certainly know, as you say, what the Illinois appellate court would look at it, because they looked at it in People versus Simmons. You know, and in that case, the defendant stood over the victim and shot him in the head only once. And the Simmons court, you know, held that there was no doubt that a jury would have found that the execution style shooting was accompanied by exceptionally brutal or heinous behavior that would be indicative of wanton cruelty. But I have to tell you, you have given me some sleepless nights on this, because sounds good.
No, myself included. I mean, it's not an easy
issue. Because, the statute requires that the behavior be both brutal or heinous. Clearly met here, because brutal is, you know, brutal it was. But indicative of wanton cruelty, the second prong, which requires proof that the defendant consciously sought to inflict pain and suffering on his victim. And, the statute is met generally if you've got behavior that involves prolonged pain, torture, premeditation. But here, the behavior was, you know, repulsive, cold-blooded, devoid of mercy. I mean, it's so horrendous. But I kept going back and forth in my own mind as to whether there was proof that he consciously sought to inflict the pain and suffering on the victim. It's sort of like they shoot horses, don't they? The execution-style shooting is designed to kill a victim nearly instantaneously. And it would seem that if one bullet to the brain had done it, that had been done.
I think that's right, Your Honor. The way the expert at trial spoke about this, Mr. Sims was the forensic pathologist. He indicated that all three shots, or four shots, it's not entirely clear from the record, that the shots to the side of the head were all grouped very closely together, and that the stippling was very close. So it seeming to indicate that there are open questions on whether the victim was conscious at the time based on that first shot. Whether, you know, and bringing that People v. Simmons case back out, teasing that out, that victim was conscious when the murder occurred.
Can't we assume, based on the comment that Mr. Gray supposedly made about how he was trying to make sure that they couldn't be identified or something along those lines, Mr. Gray at least thought that there was some reason to think that the victim was conscious and not dead and maybe would even survive? And does that matter?
It matters to the extent that an intense a question to resolve on the application of the aggravating factor.
And on the wanton cruelty, if he thinks he's shooting somebody who's actually potentially salvageable, then that makes it seem worse to me somehow.
Well, the witness elimination point I don't think works in favor of the state, though, Your Honor. I think it's one of those issues, again, that we're dealing with. We don't have a clean factual record on this case. We're not dealing with evidence clearly at trial going to what Gray intended to do on this question. All we have is a statement that he gave to the state's attorney general while he was in custody. And based on that decision, the sentencing judge was teasing out, again, what he thought Gray wanted to do. If Gray goes back on the stand and has this issue redecided, maybe we'll get a better understanding of what was actually going on. Maybe we can pull back Tim Montgomery, or maybe we can pull back Tommy Smith and ask them what actually went down and the timing of the instances. And to be honest, Your Honor, the victim ended up being was in a coma and suffered brain damage from that first shot, it seems, from the record. And the family decided to pull life support. So I don't know how much traction the state gets from saying that Mr. Gray was trying to eliminate a witness, and that supports their indication that he was acting with wanton cruelty.
Well, all I'm saying is maybe the objective facts would have shown that the victim was already unconscious in a coma, but the subjective point of view of Mr. Gray seems to be, I mean, for all I know, he was moving. I mean, I don't really know, but Mr.
Right.
Gray seems to have thought that more needed to be done, and I think that that may be a relevant fact. Certainly the state court seemed to view that as a relevant fact in applying the wanton cruelty part of this test.
Aren't we supposed to look at this from the state's appellate court, looking at this as looking at their harmless error review in an objectively unreasonable manner? Don't we have to look at it that way?
No, we don't, Your Honor.
There's at least some Supreme Court cases say that. If we look at this, and remember that in their situation, what they actually said, I know you know this, it said, we have no doubt that when presented with these facts, any jury would have found that the crime was committed in a brutal and heinous manner indicative of wanton cruelty. We conclude, therefore, that defendant has failed to show that the error was prejudicial. They admit it's an error, but it said it wasn't prejudicial. And I think, don't we have to look at this? Was that objectively unreasonable?
I think Your Honor's pointing to the AEDPA standard of review when a state court's applying clearly established federal law. That analysis has been tweaked by the Supreme Court's decision in Frey v. Plyler in 2007, which says that regardless of whether a state engages in harmless error review or plain error review, this court has an independent obligation to apply the Brecht standard and determine whether the error itself had a substantial and injurious effect on the jury verdict and, in this case, the 80-year sentence.
So we can override and interpret the state's interpretation of its own law, then?
That's correct, and that's based on the Supreme Court's decision in Frey v. Plyler. And also, and just also building on that AEDPA point, what's required, even if we were to go to that objectively and reasonable question, is a clearly established federal law at the time. Washington v. Ruswenko hadn't been handed down and said that these sorts of Apprendi errors could be subject to harmless error review until 2006. So even at the time of the Illinois Appellate Court's decision, there was not clearly established law on this point that the Illinois Appellate Court could have relied on. I'd like to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Mr. Trouble.
Good morning, Your Honors.
Good morning.
Counsel, and may it please the Court, I'm Assistant Attorney General Carl Trouble, representing the respondent warden. Your Honors, this is another unpreserved Apprendi error case, and federal habeas review is not available because the state court relied on its procedural law that because it was an unpreserved error, he had to show plain error in order for the state to reach the merits.
Now, I have some questions, actually, about both state law and about your preservation. One of the initial mistakes in this case is that sentencing counsel fails to file a post-sentencing motion. But can you tell me whether in a properly filed post-sentencing motion, counsel has the obligation to identify the particular sentencing errors that counsel wants to challenge?
Yes, Your Honor. He would have to raise specific sentencing challenges. He couldn't just say, well, I challenge my sentence in general, okay, and that would cover everything.
Right. So then I come to the point that Apprendi hadn't been decided yet as of the time of the sentencing. So I don't think that the either filing or non-filing of the post-sentencing motion has anything to do with his ability to raise Apprendi before the Illinois Appellate Court, because the post-sentencing motion would have long since been overdue by the time June 26, 2000 rolls around, and after a sentencing of December 18, 1998. So I don't think that has much to do with it. But what I really want to focus on is the cause and prejudice from the ineffectiveness of counsel, because the state has argued that he did not raise properly in his post-conviction proceedings in the state courts the ineffectiveness of counsel point. But I've looked at the state at the brief that he filed, and I'm particularly looking at in the appendix, pages 89 and 90, and it looks to me that he raises this very clearly. It's page 89 has a bold-faced heading: counsel paren appellate was ineffective, where counsel failed to keep abreast of law during the pendency of the defendant's direct appeal. And it goes on and talks about that. The next page, it's Roman numeral 3, the petitioner was denied his right to effective assistance of counsel in violation of the United States and Illinois constitutions, where counsel fails to file the right sentencing motion. So that's raised. Now, whether they address it or not, whether they are persuaded by it or not, obviously that's a different question. But it seems to me at the Illinois appellate court level, it is raised. And then you come to the supplemental petition for leave to appeal at the Illinois Supreme Court, and you have what looks like an ambiguous order. The court doesn't take his supplemental petition, but they don't say it's just a one-sentence order. So I think it's quite possible that he, in fact, did manage to get these points through his state collateral appeal. Now, as I was saying to your opponent, even if they're there, I mean, there's an issue about prejudice, finally, that we have to confront. But
right. You've given me several things to address, Your Honor. I'll try to get to them quickly and then maybe expand upon each one. Your opening premise is incorrect based on United States v. Cotton, a U.S. Supreme Court case that said unpreserved Apprendi errors, you still have to apply a plain error analysis. It doesn't matter that Apprendi did not exist at the time. As this court pointed out in United States v. Valenzuela, Apprendi didn't come out of nowhere. Several attorneys had taken the initiative, including Apprendi's attorney himself, obviously, to go ahead and argue the Sixth Amendment-based Apprendi claim in state court cases as it was developing in the U.S. Supreme Court and federal cases.
I'm familiar with that. That doesn't seem to be the way Illinois was handling things, which gives us an extra wrinkle here.
And that's not the way some Illinois appellate courts initially handled it.
Any Illinois courts?
Yes, Your Honor. The Illinois Supreme Court eventually, in Crespo, settled this issue and stated that this was a forfeited issue, and therefore he had to show plain error. And on page 52 and 53 of the supplemental appendix, that's what the state appellate court cited to when it said he had failed to preserve this, so based on People v. Crespo, we have to apply a plain error analysis. So that's an express holding of forfeiture, and it's an express reliance on a procedural doctrine that removes this from the purview of federal habeas relief.
I think that's a very broad reading of some of the decisions from this court, that anything that's reviewed under plain error is automatically immune from habeas relief. Very broad reading of our case law.
And again, Your Honor, I would disagree based on what the state appellate court did here was it applied its forfeiture rule. Its forfeiture rule is only excused under Illinois state law when the petitioner can show plain error, and that was ultimately the holding in Crespo and Thoreau.
Right, but that's why I jumped over to the post-conviction, because forfeited errors, if there's cause and prejudice, can be addressed. And
exactly
so
right,
that's why I spent more time in my question on saying it certainly seems to me, contrary to your brief, that at the Illinois appellate court level this issue is raised. I recognize you have the complexity of the supplemental PLA or at least what I should say is that the ineffectiveness of counsel was presented to the state courts, which, if accepted, would then lead you to the Apprendi error.
Right. And there's two grounds under the fair presentment doctrine to deny cause and prejudice under the ineffective assistance of counsel claims. The first and most obvious, and the one that's most strictly governed by prior Seventh Circuit authority, is the failure to raise it in the Illinois Supreme Court. He did not raise it in the Illinois Supreme Court in his initial PLA, and that's undisputed. He filed a motion for leave to file a supplemental PLA, and that motion for leave to file was denied. And under Colley v. Detella, this court has already held that that type of filing is insufficient to fairly present a claim, so therefore it can't satisfy the cause and prejudice test
Forgive me, but so we can't say because the court denied him leave to file that supplemental petition, we can't say that the ineffective assistance of appellate counsel, which was what was raised in the supplemental petition, was ever fully presented to the Illinois Supreme Court. And, you know, I mean, of course, we don't know whether the court denied the supplemental petition on its merits or as untimely.
Well, I would disagree, Your Honor. We do know that they did not reach the merits because...
Well, yeah, we know they didn't reach the merits, but we don't know if they denied the petition on its merits. I mean, those are two different things.
Well, I would disagree, Your Honor. If they didn't reach the merits, then they certainly didn't deny it based on the merits. What they denied was the motion for leave to file a supplemental PLA. And as I said, under Colley v. Detella, which is governing precedent in this court, that's insufficient to reach the motion. Now, petitioner cites to an unpublished decision, Kaiser, and argues the contrary. But I would distinguish Kaiser. First of all, it's not governing authority like the Colley v. Detella case because it is unpublished. But second of all, the supplemental motion or the supplemental brief that was filed there was filed while the proceedings were still ongoing. Briefs were still being filed, and the appellate court had not reached a final decision yet. So it had before it the pro se arguments before it reached an opinion in the case. Here, the Supreme Court of Illinois had already denied the PLA. Petitioner had already filed a federal habeas petition and, in fact, had filed what's equivalent to a reply brief in those proceedings, and then decided, oh, you know what, I'll go to the Supreme Court and I'll exhaust this ineffective assistance claim by raising it in a late PLA. But the Supreme Court denied him leave to even file that, and under Colley, this court would have to overrule Colley in order to hold that that was a fair presentment. Now, Your Honor, to address what's perhaps a more contentious point, it's not clear whether Lewis v. Stearns or Malone v. Wells governs the failure to present this in the appellate court. Under Lewis v. Stearns, it would appear that the fact that he simply raised these facts within the plain error argument is insufficient, but petitioner points to Malone v. Wells. Malone v. Wells, however, distinguished itself from Lewis v. Stearns very narrowly, and it said that because this was an ineffective assistance of appellate counsel claim that was trying to resume an ineffective assistance of trial counsel claim as part of the cause and prejudice test, that it was okay. But here, it's completely different facts that look much more like Lewis v. Stearns. In Lewis v. Stearns, it was a claim of ineffective assistance of counsel for failing to raise a Batson claim, and I can't remember the exact second claim, but it was something about an improper identification, I think. And Lewis v. Stearns held that that was an insufficient way to raise the claim in order to fairly present it to the state courts. So that, I would grant you, Your Honor, is the most contentious area of our procedural default argument, but all the other areas are covered by express governing authority that this court would have to overrule in order to find that the issues were fairly presented. So since it's clear he didn't present it to the Supreme Court in a way that was fairly presented under this court's binding authority, there's no need for this court to reach the decision of whether Malone v. Wells governs or whether Lewis v. Stearns governs, unless it wants to. And, of course, our argument is that Lewis v. Stearns would govern.
There I really think you're on weak grounds, because looking at all the materials presented to, first in the original post-conviction, and then to the Illinois Appellate Court on appeal, he really is talking about ineffective assistance of counsel. I don't think there's any secret. I mean, certainly the Supreme Court doesn't want people to sit there and guess from some code word, but this looks pretty clear. Now, I recognize what your arguments are in the PLA, right. And I think we just have to decide what we do with this one sentence, you know, the petition is denied, you know, the motion for leave to file the supplemental petition, as you correctly said.
Right. And again, Your Honor, we would argue that that's governed by Colley v. Dottella. But if Your Honors disagree on all of those procedural points, as you noted out in your opening questions to opposing counsel, he would still have to show that he meets the prejudice standard under Brecht, which he cannot do. He made a statement himself to the police that he had to shoot this person because he might identify him from the bar. I'm not using the exact words, but it was something to that effect.
In effect, yes.
And that shows that in his mind, he was acting with the belief that that person might recover and later identify him in court, which indicates that the first shot or two from the co-defendant in this case was not sufficient. And there's an important distinction here between Apprendi and between cases that hold that federal courts cannot reinterpret state law. We have several state court decisions on point showing that when a victim is down and helpless and then is shot, that that is brutal or heinous under Illinois law.
So therefore, that's the state law definition.
That's the state law definition, which this court cannot overturn.
Right.
And we know that if jury instructions were given, the jury would have been told a definition of Illinois law, something similar to the fact that when a helpless victim is down on the ground, that's an indication of brutal or heinous and indicative of wanton cruelty. So this court can't overturn those Illinois court decisions, and those decisions are cited in our brief, People v. Payne, People v. Simmons, and People v. Champs. Those are also very similar facts where there was a helpless victim who had already been injured to some extent or was running away when they were shot. In People v. Alvarez, which Petitioner talked about in his opening argument, the victim was similar to the People v. Andrews case that he talked about in his brief, and the victim was walking home and someone just shot him from behind unawares. He wasn't already down on the ground and suffering when the shot was fired. In People v. Andrews, it was the carjacking case where the person just jumped into the car and then shot the victim. He wasn't already down. He wasn't already helpless. People v. Golden is distinguished because there a victim was shot in a struggle as he was falling to the ground. It wasn't that the shot took place as the victim was already on the ground. And finally, in People v. Rodriguez, that was a crime of passion and a crime of anger. Here we know it was not a crime of passion or a crime of anger, and therefore the fact that he did make this statement to the police is important to the finding of brutal or heinous and that it was made with wanton cruelty, because we know it wasn't something that he made just out of the passion of the moment. He made a calculated decision to kill someone that was already on the ground and suffering. And under Illinois law, we know that a jury would have been instructed that those facts indicate a brutal or heinous finding. A couple of other points I just need to touch on really quickly. There was some discussion earlier about whether there's any deference to the state courts. We do give deference to the state courts' factual findings in federal habeas review. One of those factual findings were that any of the shots could have caused the death, and we don't know that he was unconscious when the first shot was fired. And we do know under the facts that he made that statement to the police showing his subjective belief that that person was still alive. And more importantly, we know the jury found him guilty of first-degree murder, so the jury believed that the victim was still alive when that shot was fired.
Didn't he die the next day in the hospital?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
I thought he lived for a short period of time.
To be honest, Your Honor, I don't remember. The testimony from the expert witness, though, was that any of the shots could have been the one that killed him.
Okay, but I misunderstood something, but I thought for some reason or other he was declared dead the next day in the hospital.
Yeah, and for whatever reason, that's escaping me right now, Your Honor.
I think that's right. He dies the next day. He's in a coma, and they pull the plug, but it doesn't mean that the shot didn't kill him.
Right. Any of the shots could have killed him. But I think Your Honor was going to the point of, and I see my lights on, if I could briefly answer your question. I think you were trying to express the thought that that showed he was still alive and suffering when those shots were fired, which would indicate wanton cruelty. So for all of those reasons, Your Honor, I'd ask that you affirm the district court's judgment below denying habeas relief. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Trebo. Mr. Lewski?
Very briefly. The state hangs its hat on Colley, Cawley is entirely distinguishable. We don't have the state court decision cited in Cawley at all. The court just mentions the fact that there was a late filed initial PLA. Here we obviously have an original PLA that was timely filed, but we do not have from Cawley what the state Supreme Court said denying that late petition. If the court had said petition denied because late, then of course procedural default applied, and obviously the court in Cawley was correct. But we don't know that from the decision in Cawley, so it's very unclear how the court was ruling on that case. And then real quick on the question of the harmlessness of the error, the state is again pointing to the fact of this statement that Gray gave to the police, to the Attorney General after the fact. What we have isn't so much witness elimination as it is maybe spontaneity. We have an individual who lands in a crime, an individual that he doesn't even know is going to be there, commits this heinous act, shoots an individual point blank in the head. He's panicked. The guy, a friend of his, it appears from past dealings, asks him to tells him to finish things off. Who knows what happened at that time? And the court, the state has to hang its hat on this one statement from a case that didn't even have anything to do with the question of whether the murderer was brutal and heinous to make that resolution. We request that this court reverse the decision of the district court and grant the petition for writ of habeas corpus. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr.